There's a moment most founders don't talk about. The moment when you realize you might not be the right person to run the company you started. Today, I'm talking to Nick Francis, the founder of Help Scout. He spent 15 years building the company, shaping the culture, defining the values, writing the story. And then 5 months ago, he stepped down as CEO. Not because the company failed, not because investors pushed him out, but because he came to a realization that's hard to admit. He wasn't the right CEO for the next chapter.
When you raise institutional capital, that is marriage without the opportunity for divorce. You're in it. There is no going back, and you're now on the timescale that that investor is on. I tried really hard to thread that needle, and you know, it just doesn't work out for every company and every CEO.
I'm Chris Savage, and this is Talking Too Loud. Nick, yes, you're back. So good to see you.
Thank you, buddy.
Yeah. I'm so excited you're here today. I've known you for a long time. When I met you, you were the CEO of Help Scout. Just starting, I think you were like 3 employees. Grew Help Scout tremendously. Recently, you stood away from the day-to-day and executive chairman at the business.
Yeah. First time I've been on a podcast without my Help Scout pedestal. I stepped down from the CEO role about 5 months ago. And ultimately just kind of decided it was time for me to step away, and have really enjoyed, for the first time in my life, not having a job and starting to think about and reflect on the journey. Yeah. And I've had a lot of fun doing that. I've learned a lot.
I get to see you a lot these days, Nick, and I love it.
Yeah, same. Get enough. I'm talking too loud about that. Yeah.
Can't get enough. Yeah. What are you talking too loud about today?
You know, I don't mean to give you like a non-answer, but I think for the first time in like, I've been building companies for 20 plus years. I recently stepped down. I'm sure we'll talk about that. But I haven't been talking too loud about anything for the first time in forever. Mm. I feel like I'm just listening. I'm learning to listen better. Mm. And I'm just taking a breath, which feels really good.
That's amazing.
I don't mean to have a non-answer. I'm
breathing it in is an answer.
Would you say that you are like breath maxing right now?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I'm listening too loud, Savage.
Boom.
Oh, God. That's good. Well, look, things have changed a lot. You're coaching. You're helping organize leadership groups and all these different things. But I want to bring more people in on the journey. So I think we should start with Help Scout and just start like when you started it. What did success mean to you? Like, what were you trying to do when you started Help Scout?
Yeah, so we founded the company in 2011. And I remember this very specifically because somebody asked, like, what's your dream for Help Scout? And I said, I just want to build products people love. And for some reason, that person didn't seem so satisfied by my answer.
Who do you think you are? Products that people love.
I just, you know, like, I don't know.
That's it?
We're these naive like builders and product people. And I just look at customer support as a trade, and it looks very sad. And these products look very difficult to use, and I don't want to use any of them. And I would like to make a product that people really love to use. And then I think they convinced me to eventually say like, oh my gosh, it'd be the most incredible thing to build like a $20 million business. But I could really like care less about that sort of outcome. And I think maybe something that I've learned to appreciate over the years is how weird or unorthodox my value set is for building a company, right? Like, not everybody thinks about success just in terms of building something other people will love, or building a workplace that people would love to do their best work in. But well, that's what drove me.
Yeah, it seems funny because I think because you think about starting a company, it's like, well, why do you want to do it? Well, to be rich, right? Yeah. Like, isn't that why we do it? Money? Isn't that the great motivator?
I mean, not for me. It's the funniest thing. And I think over the years, I've really learned to appreciate and value the fact that I'm looking for something deeper. And that's actually something that makes me special as an entrepreneur and able to build something that truly stands out.
Yeah. Did you think, I mean, so was there something like something in your family, something in your childhood, something that really made you see that as the goal, like of like, I want to build something that people love. Like, was there something that you experienced that you loved? And you're like, I want to create this feeling. What was it? Do you know?
You know, part of it does feel like it's like a DNA level thing that just I'm obsessed with craft and quality and trying to do things.
You that are.
I can be really proud of. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think the only thing I could point back to in terms of my childhood or upbringing is that I was raised by parents that told me I could do anything and I believed them. And I just think that's another thing that upon reflection, it's the best gift you can get. And not many people are given that gift. And so in that regard, I do feel really lucky to have parents where I'm like, hey, I want to start a business. Hey, when I'm like 13. Hey, I want to do this. I want to be a pro basketball player. I want to do whatever. And they're just like, you've got this, you know, that's the world I grew up in. And so if I told them I just want to build a profitable software company, then I think they would say, you got it, go.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I remember, I think you tell me if you remember this too, but the first time I met you was when we were shooting a video, I think, with Buzz Agent, and Help Scout was like in that Buzz Agent office. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
Boston. Yeah. And I think that's the first time we met in person. And I definitely remember, I don't know if it was that interaction or if it was shortly after, that you were really obsessed with products and you were really obsessed with craft and quality. And knowing you now, this is who you are. Like, it's like, I hate to blow up your spot, but this man loves watches. This man loves cars.
I do.
But really, this man loves stories. And I think that's what's interesting is like, it's always been about like, oh, this coffee is so good because of where it's sourced and their process and the things, and they take care of the employees and it's a B Corp and it's like looking for all the ways that you can like level up a product or experience is clearly something that worked, right? Like, and I guess like, I just find that really interesting because it doesn't feel like the reason to start maybe that people think of, but it's definitely the reason to keep going. And it's the reason to build a culture, build a product, build an org.
I think you just articulated it really well. I wanted to write a story. I wanted to write a story that others could look at and be like, wow, I'd like to do something like that. Because the truth is I was growing up looking at the stories other people had written, being very inspired by you know, these great companies, these great software products that were built. And, you know, it's the inspiration from those stories that led me to become who I am. So if I can create a story that's meaningful to other people in some way, then job done.
Yeah, it's awesome.
That is awesome. Well, if you were wanting to write a great story and you start with this like idea, I want to build a product that people love, where does that story get complicated? Where does it get spicy?
Yeah, I think for Help Scout, it gets a little bit spicy when you become very ambitious about thinking a little bit bigger and trying to identify what the company's potential is. And I can only really explain this upon reflection, but something that I've always said that I believe now more than ever is that there's a thin line between being principled and being stubborn. And as a first-time CEO, I really didn't want to be stubborn about hindering the business's potential because I wanted things to be a certain way. And I think as a result of that, I ended up saying, you know what, maybe we do need to raise money. Maybe we do need to hire all these people. Maybe we do need to try to lead the market in order to achieve the business's potential. I don't want to get in the way of that. But what I ultimately ended up doing was, you know, in a couple of spots, because I'm really proud of what we built on the whole, but in a couple of spots, I do feel like I compromised my principles a bit, you know, because it's such a thin line, it's really hard to know. And something I've gotten better at over the years is understanding when I'm being principled about something and it's good to say no, it's good to have a hard opinion on it, and when it's actually just being closed-minded. But that was hard for me to see initially. And so I think that's when it gets spicy. Help Scout ended up raising capital from great investors, by the way. It really has nothing to do with the people involved. It's just at the end of the day, it led to, 15 years into the company, me feeling like I wasn't the right person for a job at my own company.
Whoa. That's a bold.
That's wild.
That's a bold statement.
Yeah, it was hard.
Yeah, that is really hard. I think also, it's funny because one of the things I think about a lot is you have to have these beliefs that often feel like religious beliefs. Like,
yes.
You have to, the only way to do it, right? Like you're going through the darkness with this religious belief that if we do this certain way, it's going to work out. And then if you're fortunate to basically do these things long enough, eventually it does work out. And you're like, oh man, this is awesome. Like my religious belief is correct. And then you try it again and you build more conviction. And then sometimes like the third time or the fourth time or whatever, that very belief will stop what you're doing from being successful.
Yeah.
And it's a very hard thing to grapple with, I think, is like having these really strong opinions and being really focused and saying no to a lot of stuff. And then suddenly realizing, oh, the world changed or the market changed. And for me to deliver on the thing I want to deliver on, I actually have to go back against the very thing I was for or whatever.
Right.
Like with us, it was sales. We did not have a sales team. Well, Brett and I started, then we had two people. One guy was sales guy. He was awesome. But then as we started to get traction and figure things out, our business model didn't make sense to have sales. It was like $25 a month. And so we worked incredibly hard to have no sales team. And we got to 10 million with no sales team at all. And then I will never forget I would give talks about this, like sales. You don't need sales. It's completely self-service. Like, of course, like the best sales is no sales and, all of these things. And I really believe that we'd found this new way of doing this. And then I was talking to someone on the team who told me that they had talked to what would have been a potential customer and that Wistia sucks. And Wistia sucks because they had reached out to us and basically trying to buy, they thought, a big account. And we had treated it like touchless support. And I'd been like, we don't get on the phone. We don't talk to you. I was like, yeah, Wistia sucks. Like they have a really bad customer experience. And I remember have the feeling of like, wait, how many people are like this? And I started looking. And there's a lot of people who could not buy without talking to us. And we were telling them, we will not talk to you ever. So for all those people that are getting a terrible experience, and this religious belief of like, we can do this with no sales actually was making a much worse experience for lots of potential customers. And so we had to like eat our words and change. And that was like very hard. And fortunately, we had the time to do it. But I don't know. There's so many things like that I can think of. I'm sure you have similar things.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we've both been on that journey. We've been on a bunch of other similar sort of strategic journeys where your principles and your values are constantly being stress tested. And you don't always make the right call. Because I think what you learned in the end is we can do sales, but we're going to have to do it the Wistia way.
Exactly.
There's not a playbook I can pull off the shelf and do sales the Wistia way. And yeah, there are times as an entrepreneur where you feel like, can you just give me a playbook that works? But if it goes against who you are at a DNA level of the company and the people behind it, then it's not going to work, even if it works for everybody else. And so there's a lot of those sort of things at the strategic or tactical level that will really stress test who you are as a company. And the weirder you are in your values and principles, the more you're not going to be able to use anything off the shelf.
And are you, I know you said a lot of this thinking you can kind of only do in hindsight, right? Like it's really hard to kind of process that as you're building the plane, so to speak. Mm-hmm. I guess in hindsight, are you grateful that like you couldn't borrow a playbook from somebody else? Like how did that help you, I guess, in the end, or hurt you, or both?
I'm really proud. I'm not going to look back and say that I've got any regrets about 15 years of running my dream company. I don't have any regrets. Are there things that I have unfinished business as an entrepreneur. So are there things that I'm going to do differently when I do the thing that's next? Yes. But man, I'm so proud of the culture that we created and like the jobs that we created and a place where people really felt like they could do their best work and going through becoming like a public benefit corporation. And really, we weren't perfect. We were far from it, and we are far from it. By the way, we're still a company. We're still doing great. But I think laying that groundwork and that foundation was incredibly valuable. It was such a privilege. And, you know, I hope I set the company up for long-term success. I just realized I wasn't the right person to run it eventually.
You know, there's also, just to go even one step further, what we're talking about in terms of like the mistakes, the religious approach and figuring out for you. You said like do sales in the Wistia way, right? Like, I think one of the things that I eventually learned was that if you want to do something in a truly world-class way, you often have to take the risk and figure it out for yourself. Like it has to fit perfectly in with your strategy, your culture, your product, the experience you're making, your customer expectations. And that's just really hard to do when you're copying someone else because you don't know why you're copying them. You don't know all the details of what worked and what didn't. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, why a lot of the times I think the companies that are just trying to emulate don't ever really figure it out versus like, yes, you have to go down a road where I would say you're doing more things for the first time, probably more things don't work. But ultimately, if you get things that do work, they end up hopefully being more lasting and more tied into like the unique proposition of the business.
You know, something that, some advice that I got along the way that I know you got a lot of as well was when you're scaling the company, hire people that have seen the movie before, right? Hire based on people who have had this great experience somewhere else. And I think that you and I have found, particularly when you're running a weird business, that experience rarely translates. And
yeah,
that advice is so difficult to hear as a founder because you're like, of course, I don't know all the answers. Of course, I'm doing this for the first time. I don't know how to do sales. I should bring in somebody who's seen that movie before. And maybe you should. But man, that advice ended up, you know, leading me down a path that was really hard to navigate and kind of back away from. Is that an experience that you feel like you had as well?
Oh, 100%. I mean, I think it's such a classic thing. I mean, as you said, see the movie before. I don't know if that's just like Boston nomenclature, or just like startup stuff in general. I don't know, but like, I remember people asking.
I've never heard that.
You never heard that? People be like, do you have anyone who's seen the movie before? And I'm like, what are they talking about?
You're like, what freaking movie?
What movie?
Are you talking about The Social Network? Are you talking about Gladiator? Like, what are you talking about? But yeah, no, we certainly made that same mistake. And I think the funny thing is we've definitely hired people who've been wildly successful who've, quote, seen the movie before, but they are willing to throw out what they'd seen.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Where they came in, they're like, oh yeah, I've seen how this works. And then they're like, I'm not sure it's going to work here though. And it's like, well, why not? It's like, well, it seems like you're different in these ways. Like I'm going to have to explore and see. And then it's like, yes, of the 10 things it took to get the job done, six of them or five of them translate. And the other five are totally bespoke and make sense to Wistia. But without that, it almost never works. And I think that's like it is such an easy trap to fall into. It's like, and I agree with you. It's advice that sucks to hear. Hey, guess what? You're going to have to figure it out. it's the advice. It's like, I'm sorry out there. There is no easy answer. You have to figure out what makes sense for you, which really is, I don't know if you agree, but I feel like a lot of this is like why there's so much of like entrepreneurship advice is like mental health and how in tune with you are your feelings and how well do you know your own strengths and weaknesses and like how in touch with you are the customer? Because like, if you know all those things, then you're in a better position to come up with the right answers or to find the right people.
Yeah. You know, the other trope that I can't stand now is hire great people and get out of their way.
Yeah.
Because one, this assumes that you know how to hire great people, which every CEO tends to overestimate their ability to hire great people. It's kind of like driving. Every, especially dudes, think they're way better drivers than they really are.
Let's hear it. Let's hear it, Nick.
PEO, when you're hiring, it's a very similar thing. So one, even if you do hire someone great, I think the worst thing you could do is get out of their way. I think the best thing that you could do, and I'll quote the, I think it's the head of engineering at Shopify. You don't block them either.
Shut them down. Hire them on hard block.
Pair with them on hard problems. That's what I would say. Like, get in the details with them.
Yes.
And co-create what the company needs to be successful.
That
and
part.
We're so worried about micromanagement or and all the optics around like a founder or a CEO being too into the details. But in my experience, that's also the key. You can bring somebody in that's seen the movie before, but then you're going to ride together to co-create whatever sort of successful outcome they want to create.
Yes.
And they can have all the credit, but you got to do it together.
Yeah.
We had... I'm forgetting his job title, but Jeff Charles from Ramp. Maybe he's the VP of product.
He's now the chief product officer. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he was talking about the way that he manages down and the way he manages up. And he talked about that co-creation moment, especially with new hires. Mm. Do you remember this, Savage? That like the first, I think it was like the first 3 months, they're really in lockstep. And he kind of lets that expectation be known from the jump. Like, we are going to be in the weeds together. I'm going to learn how you work. You're going to learn how I work. And then we can kind of like get to this next juncture point.
Mm.
I love that. Like, that doesn't feel micromanagey to me. Like, that feels really smart and strategic.
It's like you're setting people up. It's hopefully the best chance of success everybody has, right?
Yeah. It's just not conventional wisdom for some reason.
No, it's not. I mean, the advice you're talking about is what everybody says. And you do want to hire people that are better than you at the thing that they do, but you need to help them get there in the way that makes sense in the company that you're at, that you're supposed to be the expert of, right? Like the market and the culture and all these other things, the product, the experience. And I think it is, unfortunately, advice that's like, that one is actually pretty easy to say. And to do in reality, it takes real time, right? Too. It's like, you think like, I'm gonna hire this person, now I'm not gonna do this. No, you're gonna have to do it alongside them. And that's going to take more time. But ultimately, on the other side of it, you can end up in a place where, you know, there's extremely high levels of trust. You have world-class people. You did hire someone better and they're taking on things that you couldn't do otherwise. And they're running circles around what was happening before. That does actually happen. But getting to that is very hard. And I think there's something else in there that you said, which is just like, I want to point to on physically point. I want to physically point to it, which is when there is something else that comes up, knowing even when things are fully delegated, when it's the right time to get back together and to co-create the solution again.
Right. Pairing up with really smart people on hard problems is actually like the best thing about doing work together.
That's what I love about my job. It's like, it's the most fun part by far.
Yeah. But the conventional wisdom again is like, nope, as CEO, you gotta delegate, right? Like that's the key word. And I couldn't disagree with that more.
It's so funny. Cause when I think of like the very stereotypical entrepreneur, I think like lone wolf, cold room, you know, like none of this collaboration, none of this, like, let's roll up our sleeves together. And then like meeting you, Chris and Brendan, I was like, what the hell? Mm. It's like, these guys are entrepreneurs?
Huh? Well, who's this loser?
They're weird. I keep using that word, but they're weird.
They're weird in like such a delightful, accessible way. And yeah, I guess like, I'm curious for you, Nick, like, how would you like debunk the myth, that entrepreneur myth? Like, you kind of already have a little bit, but like, is there more? Like, you have to be super aggressive and competitive, and like, what would your message be to folks?
Wait, so you're saying, what do you think it takes to be a great entrepreneur?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know, to some extent, I think it depends on your goals, right? Like, we know entrepreneurs who did start a company to raise a bunch of money and change the world and IPO and enrich themselves and a lot of other people alongside them. And I think that's a great mission. It's just not mine. I want to build products people love. I want to build a culture that where people do their best work. And so I don't think it's possible to really put an entrepreneur in a box, mm-hmm. so to speak. Like there's such diverse wants and ambitions that each has. And I think there has been a sort of status quo that's developed that particularly in tech, that's not very appetizing, which is like, you know, to be a startup founder, you have to be incredibly ambitious. You have to raise a bunch of money. You have to, you know, kind of follow all of these steps. And I think over the course of the next few years, a lot of that is going to get broken down.
Wasn't it funny that like right now, basically, everyone's like, wow, with AI, you won't need to hire as many people. And like, you can bootstrap it.
Yeah.
That's like the common narrative now. It's like, hey, we're going to see all these. And it's like, this is what's being celebrated.
Yeah. Well, bootstrapping is about to become mainstream again.
Yeah.
As it always should have been, right? Yeah, yeah. VC was never meant to be the solution for every startup, but it's become the norm in a way that I don't think works for anybody, frankly. And I think it's much more, it's so awesome to see the next generation of entrepreneurs be able to create meaningful businesses and revenue on their own because they have some really powerful tools in their pocket that they can build with. And so I think we're going to revert back to the mean in a really exciting way where this is going to be a renaissance for bootstrap companies. And there will be some companies that raise VC, but I think it will be the exception, not the rule. And this ecosystem is going to be a lot better off as a result.
Yeah, I mean, so everything that's happening right now is so democratizing, right? Everyone is going to have the option to do it. And so I think that like that is also pretty different than where things have been, which is like it felt like you had to have access if you needed to raise money to build the thing. I was like, well, you're not going to have to the same way. And so that means anyone really will be able to do it. So it's going to be about like agency. And I think back to, you know, it's going to be about agency and like a belief in yourself that you can do it. It's going to be like, can you come up with solutions that are better? Like, do you have the taste to do it? And do you have a problem to solve that other people have? Like, how much empathy do you have for other people's problems? How good are you at that? And that is very different. I mean, a lot of that is ultimately also what it took to be successful, but it took that wrapped in this other bigger thing. You need to raise all this money and do all these things, like get to the scale and do that stuff.
It's one of the ways you know that we're in a really interesting cycle is when AI gives us so much power to build, and yet companies are raising more money than ever. I mean, if you're building a foundational model, I understand.
Yeah.
You're breaking new ground. Yeah. But when you're building a wrapper or something on top, or you're just building a SaaS business, there's absolutely no reason for founders to be doing a $50 million pre-seed. What is that? That doesn't make any sense to me. It's wild.
What do you think it is? Do you think it's like people think that they need to have like a bolder thing to go after to start? And so, or they're just trying to get the bag?
I think there's a notion in Silicon Valley, particularly that that VCs can be kingmakers, right? That they can actually anoint market leaders. And I don't think that's actually true. I think first to market rarely is the best to market. And I'm just excited to see a bunch of bootstrap businesses crush them.
Man, oh man, I am aggressively nodding.
You really are.
Yes.
Don't hurt yourself, Sylvie.
It's because it's exciting. It feels genuinely exciting. And yeah, the opportunity to have companies that have that clarity on vision rather than clarity on like the VC round feels like such a welcome.
Well, because at the end of the day, I do think that a lot of entrepreneurs have a very specific, idealistic thing that they want to build, an impact that they want to have. I mean, there's a lot easier ways to make money. So typically an entrepreneur is not necessarily in it to make money. They want to have an impact. But the problem is, you know, a business is built to make money. And if a business is not profitable, if a business is not actually making money, then over time, it's inevitable. You're going to have to start to compromise some of the entrepreneurial DNA that led you to build that business in the first place. That was the hard thing for me to thread over the course of 15 years. this incessant demand for grow, grow, grow ultimately meant that we had to do some very unnatural things that I felt like started to compromise like the kind of company that we said that we wanted to build at the very beginning. And so going back to your comment around like, when does it get spicy? I think it's when you try to thread the needle between building a business that has a nuanced definition of success that involves much more than shareholder value and not operating in a profitable way and actually burning capital because of this growth demand. Like that's when a startup is truly vulnerable.
Yeah, it's also, it's like you have to match the company to the entrepreneur to the company. Like even the capital structure. That's what that's what I hear you saying in there. And like Ed Holland from Klaviyo.
Yeah. He's great.
He was at some event with him and he was talking about how basically that's the what he sees people making mistakes is like they try to the entrepreneur tries to build a business that is not a match with them. Because if you keep the match right, then the chances of it everybody getting what they need is like much higher.
That's an amazing insight. And that's actually a really good illustration of a team that was able to thread the needle in terms of like ultimately raising some money. But a lot of people don't know that Klaviyo did not have much money to start with. And they were crazy profitable for a really long period of time. Every time they raised money, it was not put into the business. The business was crushing it. And I think that enabled Ed and Andrew to build something absolutely special. Absolutely to a T, like what they wanted to build, the impact that they wanted to have in the world, uncompromised because the business just did so well from a profitability standpoint that that funding just never, like the incentives were never misaligned.
Yeah. No, it's an interesting thing because it's kind of, it goes back to what we were talking about before, just like being in touch with what it is you actually want and need. And I think like from the very beginning, hopefully you don't even have to question that. That's kind of your point, right? It's like you start because you want to make an impact. You start because you understand some customer pain. You start because you have revenge that you want to get on other people and prove them prove them wrong, whatever it may be. But there's something in that. And then there's because you are who you are, there's probably some of that that needs to stay as the company scales. And when those things fracture, that's what causes people to leave or that's what causes people to make decisions, compromise on things that they might, you know, they really probably shouldn't compromise on.
Yeah. And, you know, one of our investors actually said something really wise to me at one point, which is so, so true and something to be considered. When you raise money, and you can raise some friends and family money, that's fine. But when you raise institutional capital, that is marriage without the opportunity for divorce. You're in it. There is no going back. And you're now on the time scale that that investor is on. So you got to be really careful when you make that agreement. I was really careful. I tried really hard to thread that needle and, you know, it just doesn't work out for every company and every CEO.
Yeah. This is some real shit. I think this is the stuff that I think like
so profound.
Most people aren't even in a position to talk about this. Like I'm not sure we could have talked about this while you were at Help Scout.
No, it's in some ways it's scary not having that Help Scout pedestal and just being fully confident about being the Help Scout guy.
Yeah.
But when that pedestal is no longer there, it's really interesting to see kind of what comes out. And I've noticed that it's different. And I'm sort of rediscovering like that core DNA that made me so excited to build businesses in the first place, which is fun.
It seems kind of liberating at the same time that it seems scary.
Yeah. I think it led me to the realization that I have unfinished business. there's something else for me to do. There's another company in me. So that was really fun.
That's amazing.
When you talk about the unfinished business piece, is it literally you want to be solving hard problems with great people? Is that like the core part?
100%.
Yeah.
And I love being able to do that at some level of scale where like there are a number of people who are coming into that workplace doing the best work of their life and like creating a safe space for like really great work to be done. And that excites me about making a business bigger, like beyond like a few people.
Yeah.
Is actually building an entire workplace and culture that espouses those values, and you get to see like sort of the end result and the output of that.
It's like the speed of the impact. Like the early years, I remember being like, oh, just when we get this thing out there, it's going to be so great. It's like, well, how long have you been working out? We've been working out for like a year. And like, I'm really excited for like next year for it to come out. And it was things like that for a very long time. Then the time started to compress.
Yeah.
Of like, oh, you have more people working on it. You start to figure out how to work better. And then it's like, okay, we can solve this problem more rapidly, or we can solve this problem better. And it's like Sylvia and I have talked about this on the show too, because she's now getting the dopamine hits from like Wistia things.
Yeah.
And she'll call me up and be like, oh my God, I just was at this meetup and I was talking to people about this new thing
we're doing. Drank the Kool-Aid.
Yeah. But yeah. It is a very intoxicating thing.
It's, yeah. I mean, like the most like apt metaphor I can think of is like when you're doing something physical, like exercise, like running, and you start off and it's really freaking hard. Like I remember when I started running later in life. It was very hard, but at some point it gets a little easier. And once it gets just a little bit easier, it's like you have a taste of what's possible and it makes you want to push even more. And I sound like such a tech. I sound like a tech rise and grind, you know, like that's how I sound right now. But I think the physicality of it is sort of like, it's so tangible. It's so, yeah, it's like you really, what's possible? I can't believe
it. Well, it's this rush of being connected, I think, which is like, because if you're, I have not worked for all very large organizations. My previous job experience is very small things. But I can imagine how you can pretty easily feel disconnected from the thing you're doing and like where the money comes from to pay you and like how it impacts like the customers. Like it's pretty easy in a big organization to feel disconnected. I think it's pretty normal. What we're talking about is like, oh, when the connection actually feels really strong, I think, which is like been really cool to see you go through, Sylvie. And this is what you're talking about, Nick, which is like, oh, I have this idea and I'm going to go help make it happen. And then it happens. And then it impacts a bunch of people internally because now this thing is better, but also it impacts all these customers. And if a lot of customers are using something and you actually just like literally save people time each day or help them do something they couldn't do otherwise, you are getting this like huge hit of, I had this idea and I made this thing happen. And now all these people are benefiting. It's this incredible feeling of like this connection. Yes, I can be connected to someone. Look, we do business video stuff, right? It's like, doesn't sound sexy. Like, it's just like, it's not curing cancer. It's not some Hollywood video thing. Like, you know, things I dreamed of as like a child. And yet, I know that people are using video at work and they're wasting their time, or it's not working the way that they want, or they can tell a better story, or they can inspire their team better. They can feel like empowered to do something they couldn't do otherwise, that actually that can affect their job, that can affect their career, that can affect the company. And that stuff actually really matters a ton. Like that's, you know, and I think once you understand that, suddenly when that connection is strong, suddenly it's just so inspiring and so fun, because then you're just limited by yourself. And that's like a pretty cool feeling.
Yeah. It's lightning in a bottle. Another thing I really like to tell other founders and CEOs that is true in my experience is that there is no hump that you're going to get over, right? Like a lot of entrepreneurs are like, oh, if we just get here, then we're going to be XYZ, right? And the truth is your job will never be easier than it is today. It only gets harder. And that's actually what makes it extremely gratifying in the long run. So Sylvie, running a mile might get easier to some extent, but I'd say that it's still really hard and you're just fighting for time. You're fighting for something else. Like you never feel like, wow, now I'm just on the downswing as a runner. Like you're always looking to achieve more. And I think that that's actually what makes working somewhere fun. I mean, for everybody to come in being like, this is going to be hard and I can't wait. Right.
Yeah. I feel like I think about it like, Yeah, maybe the mile does get easier, but maybe the mile is no longer my goal. Or maybe the speed of the mile becomes my goal, right? Let me beat my own time.
Yeah.
Maybe I want to run a 5K. Maybe I want to run a half marathon, which I tried and had a terrible experience.
That's okay. Try again.
That's your first one. Yeah.
We don't have time for that story. Yeah. I guess the other thing is that both of you have sort of said is like, you have to like that it's hard. You got to like the challenge. And some people just don't. Some people really don't.
That's true. But yeah, I think that's right. And I think that's like, you have to like the challenge. To keep the running analogy, yeah, you'll get your time up and then you'll do longer distances. But how hard it is probably it doesn't get easier because your ambitions change.
Right.
But like how hard it is it doesn't get way harder because your capacity for the hard things gets improved.
I just think it's more rewarding. It's like, that's the dopamine, right? Is that it just continues to get more rewarding because the impact that you're having, and this is more in the company context, but as an entrepreneur, as it gets harder, my motivation only goes up because it gets more rewarding. The impact that you're having more broadly increases.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we're here.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah. Well, we wouldn't be otherwise. I mean, it'd be very easy not to be. Seriously. I mean, to your point, it's just like, it also gets addicting, which I think is like the funny part about all of this is like, yeah, it's really hard. Like, and it's addicting. It's addicting, that feeling of solving those problems, working with great people, helping customers, seeing the impact change, facing a new problem that you basically know you didn't have the capacity to deal with before. And then on the other side, being like, oh, I dealt with it.
Yeah. Well, and that's why, just at least looking back, for me, it feels like lightning in a bottle. You never know when that time is going to be different for you, right? You're going to move on. You're going to do something else. Like, and you'll look back on those days at Wistia doing your best work as when you were having the most fun ever, even though you thought it was really hard and miserable.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
In the moment.
Yeah.
That is funny. I wish, the thing I wish is like, there's also been a lot of, I know this is so cliche, but there's been so many great moments and it's still, it can be hard to hold on to those. Where like, I often look at like a really hard moments as like, well, that's why I learned the most and it was so painful. Or if I did it again, I would do it differently because I learned from it, right? And then there's all these great things too, but it's harder. That can feel harder to like call up as quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why that is.
There's something like I've read about this that like biologically it's for some reason it's easier for us to latch on to the hard thing and like the good is fleeting. Like
it's like more important to learn and avoid the hard thing again than it is to like celebrate the good thing.
Yeah. I don't know why. We need more good things.
I don't know. This might be like gambling. Right? Like the losses hurt way more than the wins.
Well, they definitely do.
And
I just think
love roulette, let me tell you.
Yeah, Sylvie should not get into crypto. Let's just say that.
No, I really shouldn't.
She's an absolute addict.
I'm not an addict.
You love to gamble. That's what you love to do.
Oh, boy. Well, now that you're in a different chapter of your story, Nick, do you have advice for other people who are like just starting their story?
You know, if I were a brand new entrepreneur today, I would implore the next generation to think about what their sort of first principles are. Like, why are they truly doing this and what do they want to be about? And write them down. If those are core values, same thing. And ensure that you can be dogmatic about those things. There's this great scene in The Bear where the chef goes in and writes all the non-negotiables. Right. I think that's like the latest season where he says, look, these are now non-negotiable in this restaurant. And I think entrepreneurs have a right to say, these are my non-negotiables, right? These are the things that I'm just not going to compromise no matter what, because that will undermine the sort of impact that I want to have as an entrepreneur.
I agree with what you're saying, Nick. And like, what I think is hard is to realize that even at the very beginning with the tiniest amount of traction, you actually probably can write that list. It just doesn't occur to you to. Like, you're like not thinking about that. You're worried about the next customer. You're worried about the next feature. It feels funny to write the core values down. It feels funny because you probably never have, but you probably actually have them. And I feel like if you can be aware of those things early, like even asking after you make decisions, why do we do that way? Mm-hmm. It will save you tremendous pain later. And I think help you get to a better place faster to take Nick's advice and to write this stuff down. Because you're going to have to. If you're successful at all, this is just comes with the territory. You're gonna have to write it down. You're going to have to communicate it. You're going to have to hire for it. You have to make decisions based off of it. This is the only way to scale. Like, you're going to do that. But often we have them, but we've just never had the opportunity or need to do that. And so it is like a skill to notice it.
Yeah. And I think that's just upon reflection, it's really easy to just have a deep appreciation for that exercise and what an impact it ends up having on the company. And I think we got it mostly right. But there are some things that I look back on. I'm like, you know what? I just don't think I was totally true to the non-negotiables in that moment for whatever reason.
You will be next time, bud.
You sure will?
Yes, I will. Yeah.
I'm excited for you and whatever's next.
Yeah, we'll see.
Yeah.
Working on it.
Oh, there'll be a lot. We know that.
A lot of options.
Dude, Nick, thank you for coming on. Thank you for coming back. It's so fun. I love where we went today. Like, this is like heady, real, concrete things all in one.
My pleasure. Always fun hanging out, buddy.
Where can people find you? Where can they connect with you?
Where can they find me? Not many places. I'm on LinkedIn. You can find me there. Or you can just visit my website, nickfrancis.is at the end. Yeah.
Or on the track.
Yeah. Come to Colorado and we can go driving.
Come to Colorado, go driving with Nick. Nick also races competitively in the online Porsche league. So every once in a while, if you are good at sleuthing, you can find a race with Nick while there's actual commentary happening while he drives, which I enjoy.
Yeah. They're all on YouTube. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
That's all true. All right. Thank you, sir.
My pleasure.
Talking Too Loud is brought to you by Wistia, hosted by Chris Savage, produced by me, Sylvie Lubau, along with Adam Day. Executive produced by Wistia Studios. This episode was mixed by Maria Passingham of Edit Audio. Listen to Talking Too Loud wherever you listen to podcasts. And hey, rate and review us wherever you listen. And check out more content from Wistia Studios at wistia.com.